Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Jackson, Michigan, and coached in the NFL for 28 years. He was the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and then the Indianapolis Colts. He is the only coach in NFL history to lead his team to the playoffs for 10 straight years and the first African-American head coach to win a Super Bowl. The author of four books, his autobiography is entitled Quiet Strength. His name, Tony Dungy, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Coach Tony Dungy, and this is what Tom Izzo has to say of him. Tony Dungy may just be the best coach slash person in America. Coach, welcome, an honor to have you.
Well, thank you very much, Jack, and that's certainly high praise from Coach Izzo. I feel the same way about him, and I just really admire coaches who do it the right way and develop people as well as players, as Coach Izzo does.
You proudly state, Coach, and I quote you, that you had two Hall of Fame parents. Tell us about your mom and dad.
Yeah, I grew up in Jackson, Michigan, a small town upbringing, and I wouldn't trade it in for anything in the world. Both my parents were teachers. My dad taught junior college, actually, science, biology, and was just a great dad. My mom was a high school English and public speaking teacher, and they cared about not only us as kids growing up, but all the kids in our community, and just were always there and very, very special, and got us started in the right way, directed us towards the Lord, directed us towards honoring other people and respecting your elders, just all the things that made it easy to grow up and do well.
How did you fall in love with sports, and specifically football?
Well, football was actually the last sport that I played. Both of my parents enjoyed it. My dad liked spectator sports, but he was more the individual sport person. He ran cross country and boxed and did a lot of individual sports. My mom was the team sport person and liked basketball and softball. So from as early as I can remember, playing in the backyard with my mom, playing catch with my dad, him teach me how to hit a baseball, those kind of things. And then, we, as I said, we had just a small community in Jackson, and it seems like the boys that I grew up around all like to do the same thing. So from as early as I can remember, I had a group of guys that I just hung out with, and when the seasons changed, we changed and learned to play baseball and played in Little League and the Recreation Department League, played basketball at the community center, and eventually when I was about 12 or 13, started playing football. And I had watched a lot of football, but that was really the last sport that I played. That was actually the one that I was probably least good at, especially early on. But it turned out to be my career.
How was it you went to the University of Minnesota and quarterbacked for them?
You know, that's another interesting story. I grew up, as I say, in Jackson, about 25 miles from Michigan State and about 40 miles from the University of Michigan, and right in between, my dad went to Michigan, my mom went to Michigan State. I'd grown up watching both teams, and it felt like I would play for one or the other. But as time went on, it was just one of those things that the Lord worked out. Michigan State was going through a coaching change at the time. Duffy Doherty, who was kind of my hero, retired my senior year in high school, and they were looking for a new coach. Bo Schembechler was a great football coach there, but wasn't all that excited about me playing basketball, too. And Minnesota was one of the schools that was going to let me play basketball and football and try to do both. which was pretty rare at the time. So it just kind of worked out that way. I went and visited the campus and fell in love with it, and it ended up being a great move for me, even though it was hard to leave the state of Michigan, for sure.
You quarterbacked for 3 years, and then you get signed as a free agent in 77 with the Steelers. Talk about your 3 years as a player in the NFL.
Oh, boy, I tell you what, again, another one that I couldn't have orchestrated and scripted any better if I wanted to. I played quarterback all the way through junior high, high school, and college. I thought I would be a basketball player. I played 1 year at the university and ended up realizing football was going to be a better opportunity for me, and had success, you know, all the way through. Well, the draft came around, and I didn't get selected, and I was pretty devastated by that. I thought I could have been a decent quarterback in the NFL, was looking forward to at least getting the opportunity, and I didn't get drafted, but it turned out to be a blessing because that allowed me to select the team I wanted to go. I had several offers after the draft, and I chose Pittsburgh. They were in the middle of a Super Bowl run, had a really talented team. I knew a couple of the coaches on the staff. But more than anything, I wanted to play with the best. So I went there. At that time, they had Terry Bradshaw and a couple of other good backup quarterbacks. So they really weren't in the market for a quarterback, but felt like I could change positions and maybe help. So I switched to defensive back and didn't really understand why and couldn't figure it out. You know, looking back, now I know it was, you know, really to prepare me for a coaching job, but at the time I had to learn a new position, learn a different side of the ball, and grow as a defensive player, and I had a great time. Those guys, the 2 years I played in Pittsburgh and then 1 year in San Francisco, played with a bunch of Hall of Fame players. I saw how great teams got put together. I learned a lot from Coach Knoll and from Bill Walsh, who I played for 1 year. And it was an education for me as well as a thrill. We won Super Bowl 13 my second year, and I thought this is going to be easy. You know, I'll probably win four or five more rings before I get done, play about 10 years, and then go into business. But 2 years later, I was 24 years old, and I had gotten traded a couple of more times and eventually got cut by the Giants and was looking to figure out what my life's work was going to be at 25 years old.
We're talking to Coach Tony Dungy, and he mentioned that he played for two coaches, Chuck Knoll and Bill Walsh, two of the best ever. When we come back, we'll ask him the biggest thing he learned from each. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Coach Tony Dungy. One of his greatest players when he was with the Bucks was Warren Sapp. Just got into the Football Hall of Fame this year. And I quote Sapp now. He says, "Tony Dungy is the greatest man I've ever met in my life," unquote. Coach, speaking of great men, Coach Knoll and Coach Bill Walsh, what's the biggest thing you learned from each?
Oh, wow. Two great coaches. And the thing I learned from Coach Knoll when I first got to the Steelers, he said that champions don't do extraordinary things. They do the ordinary things better than everyone else. And that was a lesson for me in life as well as football, that it's the fundamentals, the details, the little things day in and day out, more than the spectacular. But probably the biggest thing I learned from him in the very first meeting we ever had, he said, you know, football now is your profession. You're in the NFL. You're going to get paid for it. But football is not your life. It's not your life's work. Part of our job here with the Steelers is to help you find your life's work. And he always talked about being involved in other things, getting involved in the community, giving back, understanding that pro football was a short lifespan and you were going to have to do things for the rest of your life. And we have a ton of guys off that team that were very successful and did great things off the field. That was probably the biggest thing I learned from him. And then I got out to San Francisco and Coach Walsh was just building the team, starting from scratch, and he would not waver from his beliefs. Even when we started off struggling, we only won two games his first year, the year I played for him. But he knew that he had the right formula. He didn't let people deter him from his beliefs. And he also believed in accentuating what guys could do. If you weren't a complete player, he would put you in position where your strengths showed up and minimize your weaknesses. And I always remembered that when I got into coaching later on. Look at what a guy can do and not what he can't do. And that was a great lesson for me.
You get into coaching. You coach for 28 years. You're an assistant coach with the Steelers, the Chiefs, the Vikings. And then in 1996, you become the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And they had just had 13 straight losing seasons.
Yes.
They were not drinking whatever Noel and Walsh were selling. How did you turn that culture around?
Well, I really utilized what those two gentlemen had taught me. Number one, it's a mindset, and you do have to change the culture. Just as you said, we had to start thinking like winners. And what that involved was not the spectacular things, but the little things, the fundamentals, the details, day in and day out of playing well on the field, but being a champion off the field in your personal life, in the community, personal responsibility, all of those things made a difference. So really trying to change the culture and then being very determined to stick with what you believe. I had a way that we wanted to play and just really sell that we wouldn't be fancy, we wouldn't be a team that fooled people, but we would execute and play harder and smarter and faster than other teams. And that was what we sold. And it took a little while to catch on, but once the players started believing in that, we started to have some success.
You're there until 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come north again, trying to get close to Jackson. You go with Indianapolis.
Yeah, we were 6 years in Tampa and built it from, as you say, 13 straight losing seasons to a team that was a perennial playoff team. But we didn't win the Super Bowl. And in our owners' minds there in Tampa, that was falling short. We didn't reach the goal. So I got let go in Tampa and was trying to figure out really where the Lord was going to direct me. Was it something in Tampa, outside of football, to continue with the roots that we had laid there? Or was it another city, another franchise? And Jim Irsay, the owner of the Colts, called me. And he said, I admire the way you coach. I think you're the perfect person to lead our team. We want to win Super Bowls, but we also want to impact the community, to develop a strong presence in the city of Indianapolis. And I think you're the perfect person to do that. So in 2002, I went to Indianapolis, and it was seven great years for me. We had wonderful football. Made the playoffs seven times in a row, finally won the Super Bowl in 2005. But more than that, really got to be around some quality people, some great young men, to do some things in Indianapolis and charity work and kind of help the Colts build a foundation there. So it was a great 7 years for me.
I heard Steve Young once say that once in a great while, a player comes along that tilts the field, a la Gale Sayers, mm-hmm. Bud Kiss, our own Barry Sanders,
yes.
And you coached such a player at Indianapolis in Peyton Manning. How was it different when you coach a player that tilts the field?
Every once in a while you get someone like that who, by their talent and their will and their work ethic, just exudes greatness, and it rubs off on everyone else. And when you have that, you have that built-in advantage. And we did have that in Indianapolis in the time that I was there. Peyton not only gave you a chance to win every game because of his skill, but he motivated everyone else. And you had that belief that you could win. And guys played above their head because they felt inspired. So it was pretty special coaching him, watching that team grow around him, and getting other people to really believe that same way. So, yeah, it does make a difference when you have a player of that caliber.
I watched the Colts play the Lions here on a Thanksgiving Day game, and I think mm-hmm. it was 35-0 at halftime. And I'm watching them, changing the call at the line, and it just, I'm thinking to myself, why can't anybody else do what he does?
Well, not everybody wants that responsibility, and he embraced it. But you mentioned that Thanksgiving Day game. That was a special one for me growing up in Jackson and around the Lions. You know, that was a tradition, watching the Thanksgiving Day game. And I never thought I'd be playing in one or coaching in one. And just being on the sideline that day, I think I had 104 tickets that I had to get for relatives and friends. Being on that field was brought back so many memories of growing up and being part of the Lions tradition. We did have a great day. I think we won that one 42-13. But, Peyton put on a special performance that day, 5 touchdown passes as I remember it.
You could have been, you know, you cooked our turkeys within the first quarter there, Coach. Okay, next subject. Let's go to February 7th, 2007. You play the Bears, Super Bowl 41, coached by your longtime great friend, Lovie Smith, and you win 29-17 in the drizzle in Miami. And you become the first African-American coach to lead your team to a Super Bowl victory. What'd you think that night?
Boy, I tell you, Jack, I was thinking about a lot of things. Number one, just how far we had come as a league in the NFL. When I came into the league as a player in 1977, there were only 7 African-American coaches, period, in the whole league. No head coaches, 28 teams at that time, 7 assistant coaches sprinkled throughout the league. So you didn't go in really thinking, boy, my future is as a coach if you're African-American. It just didn't seem that way. Well, it grew, and eventually we got quite a few assistant coaches, but the head coaching still seemed a long ways off. And then fast forward to 2007, and Lovie Smith, who had come to work on my staff in Tampa, he's coaching on the other side, and for the first time, we got 2 African-American coaches in the Super Bowl. And it just seemed like we'd come such a long way, and I was proud to be part of that. I was proud to be representing coaches that probably could have done that but never got the opportunity in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. So it felt great. I also thought back to my dad, who fought in World War II and then came out and started teaching school, and his first job was in a segregated school, all black school, because they were segregated at that time in 1951. So just thinking, you know, in one generation, we'd come from where my dad had trouble getting a job in an integrated school system to his son, you know, coaching in the biggest sporting event in America and leading the team. It was just kind of stunning. So I thought about all those things. It was a great, great win for the city of Indianapolis. But I was really gratified to be part of history and just the fact that God had allowed me to be the one to represent African-American coaches as the first. It was, again, something that I don't take for granted.
We're talking to Tony Dungy, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with Tony Dungy, the only head coach in NFL history, 92 years, to lead his teams to the playoffs 10 straight years. And as a follow-up to that, you don't swear and you don't curse. Okay? Well, you can't be a coach and not swear and curse. Or a rant and rave, you know, the Bobby Knight, et cetera, et cetera. It's impossible. How'd you do it?
Well, a lot of people did think it was impossible, Jack. I just was raised that way by my mom and dad. As I got older and went through life and got more mature as a Christian, I just believe that the way you talk to people, the way you treat people is important. I was a Christian first and a football coach second, so that's the way I was going to do it. And had pretty good success as an assistant coach. Was with the Steelers as we were winning and growing under Coach Knoll. Went to Kansas City and then to the Minnesota Vikings, and we had the number one defense in the NFL in 1993 statistically. And I started getting mentioned and started getting interviews for head coaching jobs. And when I would describe how I was going to do it, when owners would ask me about just that fact, how are you going to motivate people, how are you going to discipline them, how are you going to keep them in line without really yelling and screaming, a lot of people didn't think it could be done. And it took me a long time. I went through quite a few job interviews, coming in second or them saying, yeah, we just decided to go in a different direction before I finally got the head job in Tampa. And I remember my first meeting with them, and I said, you know, I'm not going to use profanity. I'm not going to yell at you to motivate you. If there's anybody in the room that needs to be yelled and screamed at and needs to be cursed at to play your best, come see me after the meeting, and we'll try to trade you, you know, to some other team where they do that. And nobody came to see me. Nobody said that they really needed to be cursed at to play well. So I thought it could work. And it took a little while. For some guys, it was different. But once I think the players got used to the way I did it, so many guys appreciated that. And you know, you talked about Warren Sapp earlier in the show, and I've had a lot of ex-players say they just appreciated the way I treated them and the fact that we could win, but they still felt they were honored as a person and treated fairly as a man.
Why did you retire after the 2008 season?
I started young. I started coaching when I was 25 with Coach Knoll, and so that was always kind of my plan, to be 25 years in the league. I'd be 50 and then really look to do something else. And I went a little longer than that. I went 28 years, but I always felt like there were maybe some other avenues and some other people that I could impact. I spent 25 years really dealing with young men who were between 21 and 35 for the most part. And I wanted to be able to reach out and impact some younger men and women, and also do some things away from sports, away from football. So I got involved in writing books, and that's been rewarding. My wife and I have a series of children's books now out, and we go to elementary schools and read and talk to kids about the importance of education, and that's been wonderful. I get to do some charity work, work with a fatherhood program called All Pro Dads. I also work with a prison outreach down in Tampa. So getting to do some other things away from the football field was important for me, and I'm enjoying that part of things.
Some people listening tonight, Tony, says, wow, what a fairy tale life this man has. Of course he's going to be God-centered and, you know, all for God and believing in God. Nothing bad's ever happened to him. Let's go to December 22nd, 2005. Your 18-year-old son, Jamie, your eldest son, commits suicide. How did you and your wife, Lauren, get through this?
Well, that was tough, obviously. You could go through things, and you can have setbacks and getting fired or getting sick or something happens to you, and you feel like you're going to get through it. You never expect and you don't want bad things to happen to your children. And when we lost James that night, it was very, very difficult. And in the ensuing weeks, dealing with it. But again, I think it came back to our Christian faith. And if I didn't have that to lean on and fall back on, you would say, well, what is the purpose in all this? And life just doesn't seem fair. I'm trying to do things the right way, and here you lose a son. But for us, we just had to believe that God was still in control. He knew it was going to happen. He allowed it to happen. And we had to make the best of it. And for me, a lot of it was, just as you say, showing people that you can overcome some adversity. It's easy to be positive, and it's easy to have a good face when everything is going well. But when you have negative things that happen, when you have tragedy, you know, how are you then? So I thought it was important to be the same and to try to push forward and show people that you can recover from major setbacks.
Coach Dungy, when you meet James someday in heaven, what are you going to say to him?
I'm going to be excited to see him and tell him how much we loved him. And I think he knows that, and he knows now how many people did love him. But I tell you, there's an attack on our young people, and I've talked to a lot more parents since then who have been involved in losing kids through a lot of different ways, but losing kids from suicide, and just knowing that some of these young people feel the world coming at them, and they don't know how to deal with it. And I think that's something we really have to work on, showing people how to move forward in the face of disappointments. But I'm gonna look forward to that, and that's one thing that keeps me going. I know I'm gonna see him again.
If there's a listener tonight, Tony, that's thinking of committing suicide, maybe one of our heroes from Afghanistan or some young child, what would you tell that person?
I would tell them that you may think that's the easy way out and the best way, but it's not. You have a lot more things to fulfill. God can use you in a lot of different ways, and you will leave a lot of people behind that will really be hurt. And I know if there's one thing James regrets now, it's the number of people that he hurt, the number of people that miss him. And you'll never know that. You'll never know how many people your life impacts. So I would just urge them to think about that and to know that God can take whatever they're facing and turn it into a positive and use it for good. But he can also have their lives bless so many other people.
Tony Dungy, for most athletes, sports is their life. Sports is their God. 1978, you've got a teammate, Donnie Schell, and he has a talk with you that changed your focus on life. What did he tell you?
Yeah, I grew up and accepted Christ early on because I wanted to go to heaven, and I thought I was doing things the right way. But I got sick in training camp in 1978 and was just worried about my position on the team, worried about my health, a lot of other things. And he said, you know, you have to really put God first in life if you want to truly be successful. He said, you think you have God first, but I can see from how this is impacting you that he's really not first. Football, your career, your health, there's a lot of other things ahead of God right now, and he wants to be in first place. And when he said that, I thought about it, and he really was right, because all my emphasis up to that time was being a better football player, doing the best I could, having a career, making money, getting a new contract, all the things that aren't bad in and of themselves. But if that is our primary goal, it's not what the Lord wants. And so we had a long talk that night, and I said, you know what, I do. I need to put God first, and I'm going to do that. And regardless of how this illness turns out, regardless of how the season turns out, I've got to live for the Lord first. And I started doing that in 1978 and made a big, big difference in my life. And that's where my focus still is. I have things that I want to accomplish personally, things I want to do, but I'm doing it for the Lord and not for myself.
We're talking to Tony Dungy, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Coach Tony Dungy, the first African-American head coach to earn a Super Bowl win when his Colts beat my Bears in Super Bowl 41. Coach, you and I met on Monday, February 28th of this year. It was at the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, and you were being honored. So you're going in, you're from Jackson, and now you're in with Bo Duffy, Dave Bing, L. Kaline, Ty Cobb, Joe Louis, Ernie Harwell, on and on and on. What did you think that night?
That, Jack, was a real special night, and I got so emotional. I didn't think it would happen. I knew it was going to be a big honor, but as you start thinking about the people that you grew up watching, never feeling like you would be in the same category as some of those names you just mentioned, and then the class that I went in with, some fantastic people, Mark Howe and Lomas Brown and Steve Smith, the Michigan State basketball player, Mateen Cleaves, guys had won national championships. It was really special. But knowing that for most of us, we started out there in Michigan. And Pam McGee talked about growing up in Flint and what that meant, and her feeling like she was going forward for her classmates and her friends. And that's kind of the same way I felt, that a lot of the things that I did really reflected on the upbringing I had, the way I was raised in Jackson, and it was a tribute to my city. So it was really, really emotional and very, very special.
We watch you now on Sunday nights on NBC, Sunday Night Football in America. And most people on TV today, they're screaming and ranting and raving and argumentative. And you're honest, but you're not mean. How do you make that work?
Well, when NBC asked me about coming on and being part of their broadcast crew, I was skeptical because of my personality. And I said, no, I think you have to have a gimmick to be on TV, or you have to be controversial. And my boss at the time, Dick Ebersol, said, I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for information for our viewers. I want you to be helpful. And that resonated with me. And it's been a wonderful 4 years. I've really enjoyed it because it has allowed me to keep my hand in the game, but also gives me time for some of the other things I want to do in life. But I did say that, you know, when I started this, I'm going to be honest and I'm going to try to help the viewers understand what's happening in the game. And sometimes you do have to criticize decisions or performance, but I think you can be critical without being mean-spirited, without making fun of people, really just be informative, and that's what I've tried to do.
That night, you were also interviewed by Mitch Albom live on JR, and you talked about growing up and listening to Ernie Harwell, you know, on your radio. And Ernie, maybe the most beloved man in the history of the state, used to say, whenever you have a choice of being right or kind, always choose kind.
Yes.
Why did we love him so much?
Well, Ernie Harwell was special because he felt that, and he was so humble. I mean, he was the voice of the Detroit Tigers, probably the voice of the state of Michigan in terms of sports, and yet he didn't feel like he was the center of attention or he wasn't the reason people were listening. Yes, they were listening to his voice, but they were listening to hear about the Tigers. And to me, that's what made him special, and I tried to take that into everything that I did. Yes, people were coming out to see the Colts or the Bucks, but they weren't coming out to see me. I wasn't the reason they were there. And I think I got that from people like Ernie Harwell. And the ability to be recognized by so many people and to have, you know, 90% of the state know your voice when they heard it, but still be humble and caring about people and kind, that's a special message. And I think that's why we loved Ernie Harwell so much.
Coach Dungy, you're the national spokesman for the fatherhood program, All Pro Dad. Tell us about that program.
That came into being when I was working for the Bucks, and we just had a number of people concerned about our children and where we were going and our parenting. And it's harder now to be a parent than when my dad was raising me. I could see that I wasn't doing as good a job. I wasn't home as much. I wasn't at my kids' events as much as my dad had been. So how do we counteract that? Well, it takes a little hard work. It takes determination. Maybe the same qualities that it takes to be an all-pro football player to be an all-pro dad. And again, we go back to the quote from Coach Knoll. It's doing the ordinary things better than everyone else. So that's what we try to take into All-Pro Dad, teaching men that it's not the spectacular things that cause you to be a good father. It's doing those day-in and day-out little things, being there for your kids. And it's been great. It grew from one little session in Tampa to 48 states now, and many dads coming in once a month to have breakfast with their kids before school. Just some wonderful things. So we're really excited about it.
All Pro Dad, it's a division of the non-for-profit organization Family First. Speaking of that, you got a great partnership with your wife, Lauren, 7 children, and the two of you have a great passion for inner-city education.
We do. My wife is a retired teacher, as my mom was, and she really just believes in education as I do. And we have written books, which allows us to go into schools to read our books and talk to kids about not being a football player, a football coach, you know, you can do that if you like, but being a teacher, being a writer, being involved in something where you do use your education and how important that is, and it's been a real blessing to be able to do that in the Tampa, Florida area.
Peter King has written for Sports Illustrated. He's their lead football writer for 29 years, and he said, quote, "I've never covered a more decent man in my 29 years in this business." Talk to us, Coach, about character.
That's something my mother really instilled in me, and my dad, too. You know, just feeling like that was much more important than what you did. Hey, you guys make a decision as children what you want to do in life. That's fine. You can do anything you want. But who you are and how you do it is more important, and what people think about you after they've come in contact with you, and not how good a player were you or how good a coach, but what kind of person you were. And that is always how I wanted to live. So to have Peter King, after covering me for several years and then working with me for 4 years at NBC, to have him say that, that would probably mean more to my mom than anything.
Last question. What advice, Coach Dungy, would you give to our young people this evening?
Well, I would say two things. Number one, I would say you have to, whatever you want to do in life, you can do it. And number two is you have to put God first to really be successful and to really be significant. My favorite verse in the Bible is, "What would it profit a man to gain the whole world but forfeit his soul?" That's in Matthew. And I would advise people, young people, not to do that. Don't shoot for the stars and everything in your personal life. Leave the Lord out of it and come to the end and say, it didn't really matter. I did all this. I wasted my time chasing after things. Put God first, and you'll be amazed at what you can do and how you can do it.
Coach Tony Dungy, you're a Hall of Fame coach, but more importantly, you're a Hall of Fame human being. Thanks for all you do.
Well, thank you, Jack. It has been an honor, and it's just been wonderful to be on with you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.